Well, and it's a different room.
It doesn't recognize me.
Oh, the computer stuff?
Hope she's not feeling ill. I am feeling ill because I think there's something toxic in the air. So we'll get to that later. So we're going to go out of order a little bit here. Representative Olson needs to leave and go to another committee. So we're going to run two bills he's deeply interested in first. After we've defeated those, we'll move on from that point. Okay. So I'm going to open a work session.
A public hearing
on 2393.
And while they're coming up real quickly, Mr. Co-Chair, in OLIS today, there is a packet on this bill. This allows the Department of Human Services to work with the Department of the Lottery Commission to collect prize winnings to help offset the cost of overpayments for folks who have received public assistance who owe the department money. There is a dash A3 amendment in the packet which modifies some of the language regarding at what point in the process those overpayments are subjected to the prize winning process for recovery. And there is a fiscal impact associated with the bill, and all four policy bills before you today, the fiscal impacts for those bills have been incorporated into the DHS budget recommendations you're going to hear later.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Andy Olson, assigned to the Albany. Yes, I'm also going to say the Albany Patrol Office, but no.
I called her doctor, so don't feel bad. We have other lives.
Thank you. Anyways, I represent the Albany area, House District 15. We have two bills in front of you today, but the one specifically right now is House Bill 2393, and it's recovery from lottery winnings to help out with back payments of issues for benefits through public assistance programs. I just got to back up a little bit, give you a little bit of history. It helps to get to where we're at right now. 2 years ago in Human Services Committee, and Representative Kenny Geyer will remember this, there were eight bills that were presented in front of the committee that dealt with helping give some policy changes to the Department of Human Services that would deal with public assistance programs. All eight of those did not move forward, but through the wisdom of the chair at that time, Carolyn Tomei, we created a work group, and a number of the members are here in the audience today. Great time that we had, and as a result of those meetings, we came up with three different bills. Two of them that are in front of you today were recommendations as a result of those. So what this does basically is it kind of fits in with what we've done with House Bill 2394 as well, because that was the third piece to this stool. But the avenue for a lottery to share winnings with Department of Human Services, this creates and would establish a data match process identifying lottery winnings who are delinquent in paying benefit overpayments, giving the state an opportunity to recover an estimated $209,000 per biennium right now. And that's how simple this is. The Dash 3 amendments do need to be adopted into the bill. And I'll just kind of stop right there and let Chuck kind of fill in the gaps.
Good morning, Chair Bates, member of the committee. For the record, I'm Chuck Kibner. I'm the administrator for DHS's Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery. First, I'd like to thank Representative Olson for bringing this bill forward. He's been a big help in trying to, and a big supporter of our office, and we certainly appreciate that. So as a good representative represented, this would set up a data sharing agreement between us and Oregon State Lottery. It's set up so that lottery winnings more than $600 would notify us, so we would have the opportunity to do a garnishment within the 30 days. From the moment of notification, the clock would start 30 days. We'd have 30 days to issue a garnishment and collect from any lottery winnings amounts owed to the state for overpayments of public benefits. What this would do for us is, one, it would help us respond to a Secretary of State audit finding where they felt we could utilize lottery information better. That's really where the two bills came from, is their recommendations, or the committees as well, but everybody seemed to be on the same page. about using lottery information better. Also helps us with a federal compliance with the Food Stamp Act of 1977, where it clearly states that state agencies are required to collect outstanding claims using any other using any other means, which include but are not limited to lottery winning. So they specifically expressed the desire of the states to involve their state lotteries in helping to recover state benefits. And you know, as a factual matter, it does provide for some additional recovery. I would say it's not a huge recovery piece. I mean, it's pretty small dollars. It will pay for itself over time. But given the other factors, I think that we certainly feel that we would utilize it and would appreciate the support. So that's basically the bill. Thank you for your support, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
I'm going to close the public hearing on 2393 and open a work session on House Bill 2393. Any discussion? Could I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the -3 amendment to House Bill 2393. -A3 amendment to House Bill 2393.
We have moved the -A3 amendments to House Bill 2393. Any opposition? Seeing none, so moved.
Another
second
motion. I move House Bill 2393 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation as amended.
It has been moved that we move House Bill 2393 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation as amended. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so moved. Close the work session on House Bill 2393.
Choose me. I'll do the floor.
Full. So, Representative...
He is not on full Ways and Means. We're asking
my lips. Yeah, I know you'll carry the House. Would you take it? It's a House bill. Would you take it in full?
Yes.
Well, I mean, you're not in full.
Negative.
I'm taking it to full.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson would like to carry it in the House.
Yes. Gotcha.
And on the Senate side. Yeah.
Dr. Bates, I'm just a humble servant.
Who's on first?
There's too much sarcasm this early in the morning. Okay.
Representative Olson, is there someone on the Senate side that was involved with the work group that would like to carry it?
I don't know. Let's see. Let's see. How about Senator Whitsitt over there, since his wife was a chief co-sponsor on this bill, and we'll get him up to speed on it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. So we're going to... Did I close the work? I did close the work.
Yes,
session.
Open the
so
public
we're going to open
hearing
a public hearing on House Bill 2392.
Your LFO analyst won't waste your time since you have someone to tell you about the bill.
Thank you.
<It's your>
wow. I love this committee. Have I told you that?
No more sarcasm. Keep moving.
Okay. Yes, sir. Yes, sir, Dr. Bates. Anyways, Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Andy Olson, and I'm state representative out of the Albany area. The second bill here, House Bill 2392, is a continuation of a bill that we had and concept that we had discussed. And what it does is it's really simple. I really appreciate the members from the Department of Human Services who have been involved in this and the direction that it's going. Essentially, what it does is it allows the Department of Human Services to print names on the cards for your electronic benefit transfer card, the EBT for Oregon Trail Card. For a replacement. I do think, though, and it's not in the bill, but I do think that there's got to be some discretion left to the agency due to the fact that there's going to be times that they need to respond from the field offices to an emergency-type situation rather than have to go through headquarters to receive these cards. So they're going to be crafting something along that line for rule-making on that area. Honestly, that makes sense to me. The idea behind putting printing the name on the primary card holder for the card and still allowing the family members to be able to use the card is one for accountability. I mean, when you looked at the Secretary of State audit a couple years ago and then also the information that we reviewed through our work group, it was a tad bit out of control for how many duplication cards were being used. And Secretary of State had identified that there had been over 37,000 cards that had been duplicated five times or more within a three-year period of time. Now, I got to really give some credit to the agency because they've really tackled this hard and reduced that number considerably. This here is going to help a little bit more with the accountability, but there's a serious connection, too. I think that this is an effort toward breaking down barriers for communication with the investigative fraud unit with DHS and law enforcement as they move forward. And, you know, not to go into detail with that, but that this will greatly help there. And I have, I think, Jill Gray is moving forward at this very moment. Another humble servant, might I add.
Good morning, community. My name is Jill Gray. I am one of the legislative coordinators for the Department of Human Services, and Representative Olson did a great job at explaining this bill. One of the things that we had talked to him about is still maintaining the ability of the branch offices to issue cards in emergency situations, and so we discussed about we will work on crafting rules to make that a very narrow exception, but that for all other replacement cards, they will be issued through our centralized replacement unit and have a name put on them. So we have some continuing work to do on that, but as has been true through this whole entire process, we're really happy to work with Representative Olson and others on how to make that happen.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. I was reflecting on your comments about the two of you being humble, and okay. Rep. Olson, I was wondering if you are more humble than Jill.
Chair Bates, I refuse to answer that.
A wise choice. And strike from the record the part about Representative Olson and great job. They just that's an oxymoron. So strike that from the record.
Ouch.
I will close a public hearing on House Bill 2392 and open a work session on House Bill.
And, Mr. Co-Chair, just for context, there are no amendments for this bill that need to be adopted. It's just the bill coming
right.
forward as
on 2392.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2392 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
We have a motion to move House Bill 2392 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? So moved. Close the work session on House Bill 2392.
And for carriers, can we use the same cast of characters?
That sounds appropriate to me.
Okay. You guys want carriers?
The same cast of characters.
Okay.
Copy all.
Well, let's.
Let's do this 3535 since Representative Olson is here.
Same as the
public hearings and work sessions.
Yes, both of them.
We'll open a public hearing, House Bill 3535, and call up.
She's on the list. She's coming to the table.
Dave and.
We've got Representative Paluzzo, and then we have Dave Underwinner. Does that sound right?
Hi, Dave. Come on
and
up.
And Representative Stark wants to come up, too. He's coming around, rather, not up. Around.
He didn't sign up.
Well, he's in the room.
It's too late.
Yeah, you had your chance.
Those in the audience who may be listening in, we do all actually do like each other, get along, but sometimes you can grease the wheels of progress with a little humor.
He's weird.
So, Representative.
Thank you, Senator. Good morning, Co-Chair Senators Bates and Representative Nathanson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carla Paluzzo, and I'm the representative from House District 50, the great city of Gresham, and parts of Southeast Portland. I got to tell you, this is an exciting day for this freshman legislator. I am very jazzed to be here and very pleased to talk about TANF. I do want to express my gratitude to every member of the committee for the conversations, discussions, and even disagreements we've had around TANF. I have learned a lot from each and every one of you. But I am here to speak on an important topic today, temporary assistance for needy families, commonly called TANF, which provides cash assistance and case management to low-income families in Oregon. Today, I'm asking for your support to move House Bill 3535 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Last year, the Secretary of State's office performed a TANF audit and came up with specific recommendations to improve the program in Oregon. House Bill 3535 responds to that audit and will make significant, important improvements to the program and to the experiences of families who access TANF. Those are parents and children who are our most impoverished and who will benefit by receiving assistance and skills to join the workforce, as well as support to ensure their children are successful. While Oregon is recovering from the recession, many families are still in great need. Therefore, this is the right time to make strides to improve this program and ensure we are giving these families and children the most effective services we can. House Bill 3535 does just that by making specific investments as well as policy changes. The investments work to reduce the impact of the benefit cliffs when TANF participants become employed, simplify eligibility requirements and expand services to increase family stability, improve services that can prevent families from entering TANF, and build program capacity to provide the customized, strength-based case management approach that TANF participants need to achieve and maintain family stability and employment. The policy changes enable the implementation of reinvestment proposals, refocus the program's direction, increase the program's flexibility to target local needs and opportunities, address outdated statute language, and extends the current suspensions of House Bill 2469 from 2007, which were put in place when the recession hits, to ensure families could continue to receive cash assistance during this particularly tough economic time. Colleagues, thank you for hearing this bill today and for the time you all took leading up to this to learn about the investments and secure the funding within the self-sufficiency budget. I also want to give a special thanks to the chair of the Human Services Committee, Representative Kenny Geyer, for appointing the work group that got us here today, as well as my co-vice chair and co-chief on this bill, Representative Stark, who joined me on that work group. Additionally, thanks to all the DHS as well as the TANF Alliance who worked so collaboratively on this. Thank you again for your time, and I am happy to answer any questions.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dwayne Stark, House District 4, Southern Oregon, Center Point, Eagle Point, every point in between Grants Pass and Medford. And really, I just wanted to have the opportunity to sit next to the amazing tattoos. And so if I had an opportunity to sit here and testify and have that in the camera with me, I figured I would take it. Just want to comment on a couple things that I really like about the TANF reinvestment proposal. You know, as Rep. Peluso mentioned, there was an audit that came out that wasn't very favorable for TANF. And it said there's a lot of areas that we need to improve in this area. And so I appreciate the hard work that a lot of people, advocates, DHS, I mean, people came together to figure out how do we respond in a way that corrects those things and doesn't stop there but actually makes things better. And I believe that the TANF reinvestment proposal does that, and therefore it's time to invest in that. Things that I'm especially excited about is dealing with the benefits cliff. The way that TANF is currently designed, there's such a drop-off in funding that people actually don't have much incentive to go work more because a little bit more work means a lot less money that they make. So we're resolving that. Excited about creating community partnerships and so forth. But overall, I really believe that this TANF program, and I won't bore you with all this. If you want some time, I'll come in and draw my charts and so forth. I really believe that this TANF reinvestment proposal sets the stage for an incredible amount of savings and cost reductions in the future. I believe that this is something that going forward, we're going to be getting people back to work faster, we're going to do it more efficiently, we're going to do it in a way that actually benefits our communities and in the long run saves our state a lot of money. So I think this is a very, very worthy investment to make at this point while we can, while we're coming off of high caseloads and decreasing those caseloads. Now's the time. Let's make sure we get it right so that moving forward we can succeed in this area.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Representative Booth.
Not a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank you guys for what you did, too, on this. This is a lot of hard work. And I got to offer Rep. Stark, you know, the new moniker of the new Bruce Hanna without the Tim Key. So you do your math and you do your homework. Thank you. But I believe the entire quote should be great tattoos and awesome shoes.
Mm. Thank you so much.
I will second that.
Thank you.
Never say this committee is dull, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely.
Co-chairs, people with much more brilliant minds than mine, I think, are in the room that could answer more in-depth questions if you have them.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you both.
Now, Dave and
Patty.
And Patty, I believe that. Oh, it is you. Okay.
I'll say it later.
With that handwriting, you could get a license to practice medicine.
I know. I've been told that many times. Thank you.
Dave coming up also just...
He is on the dais next door in the poverty committee right now talking about the business poverty.
Thanks.
Patty Whitney Wise, Partners for Hunger Free Oregon. Very happy to be before you. I also staff the Oregon Hunger Task Force. And with the TANF Alliance, I also help with the TANF Alliance. We've worked really hard with the Department of Human Services and the legislators to make this a good package in House Bill 3535. Now, I understand some of the provisions are actually going to show up in the budget in some of the policy option packages, particularly the one that addresses the cliff. And that, for us, was probably one of the most important pieces that we addressed, wanting to make sure that families are more stable before they transition off of assistance altogether so that they have a better chance of succeeding once they're off program assistance. The cliff really meant that for many of them who accepted a job, they would very shortly not have enough money to keep the job and would have to fall back onto assistance. So this for us is a really important step forward. Also the community grants, having that partnership between the Department of Human Services and some of the nonprofits who can provide those wraparound services for families. Again, models that have been shown to be successful for families in moving them up and out of poverty and into jobs that will pay their living expenses fully. So we're very supportive of House Bill 3535. And if Dave Underreiner had been here, he would say something similar to what he did before the House Human Services and Housing Committee about business recognizing the importance of really equipping families to be able to take jobs, stay in them, and move forward. The Oregon Business Council is very supportive of the full $30 million reinvestment, and I'm sure that's what he would have said had he been here. Thank you.
Happy to answer any questions. Seeing none, thank you. A quick comment before we close. The legislature in the 8 years of the Great Recession, which was as bad as it in the 1930s, had been for some programs that we have available now that weren't available then, saw an incredible increase in TANF population. And some of that population is people who would never thought of being in TANF. I think kept them off the streets. We did not, during that time, push hard to get them back to work because, frankly, there weren't jobs. That's changed now. It is disappointing to see the TANF rolls having not dropped back to where we thought they would. They've come down some. I think this reinvestment may help. But they have not come down like we thought they would. We're looking at a new world here of poverty, a different kind of world of poverty. The TANF cliff is significant, and I appreciate the comments here. The real problem, I believe, though, is getting these individuals an education and the right tools to move out of poverty permanently, not temporarily. And just as TANF stands for Temporary Assistance Needy Families, I don't want to see them temporarily moving out of poverty. So I'm hoping that some of the changes being made in this program, which we looked at for the last 5 months, especially the part that allows them to get an education while they're on TANF, may be a key to really making an impact in this population, then we don't end up with a situation where a significant part of our population is trapped in poverty generation after generation after generation. So thanks to the good work everybody involved in this. There's parts I would like to see more in and parts I'd like to see less in, but wiser heads prevailed, and we'll move forward. So I'm going to close the public testimony on House Bill 3535 and open a work session on House Bill 3535.
If I may, Mr. Co-Chair, there aren't any amendments to this bill, and I just wanted to, in the memo before you today, I just talk about there's within the $30 million reinvestment package, it's within the DHS self-sufficiency program, there's a piece that's directly tied to the program changes in the bill, and there's also some additional pieces of that that are really outside the program changes. So you'll see in the memo that the fiscal component related directly to the bill is about $9 million general fund, and then there'll be some other pieces we'll talk about when we get to the budget.
So for those that may be seeing this for the first time, we have two bills on TANF and ERDC, plus what's in the overall budget bill, and we'll be bringing those together. So,
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3535 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
It has been moved that House Bill 3535 be moved to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Can I make one comment, please? I just want to add my thanks as the chair of the committee. I know that the vice chair has worked really hard with the coalition. I was delighted to see the Oregon Business Council a part of that, along with the usual human service advocates, and DHS has done fantastic work. So I'm delighted to see this at this stage.
Any objections? Seeing none, so moved. I'll now open a...
Carriers, please.
You want to take it in...
Who's on the floor? Are you on the floor? May Peluso and I co-carry it.
Are you in full?
I'm not in full. I'm just on the floor.
You are. Who's in full from the House side? And from this, you're the only one.
Isn't Olson in full? No, he's not in full.
This bounces back and forth a little bit. Is that okay?
Whenever you prefer.
Yeah. You know, I tell you, Senator Winters is very involved in this too. Can we give it to her?
Sure. Whatever
she'll
you
carry
want.
It in full.
If she can, for some reason, then I'll take it.
Okay.
Sounds good.
And then. House floor, you'll work that out.
Co-carriers, I think.
Peluso and Stark would like to.
Okay.
Do it.
And on the Senate side, who was in the work group on the Senate side?
We didn't see many senators around.
Huh?
No. There were none.
There were none.
Not the work group.
Then it could be Winters.
Winters could take.
Then Winters do the both. Okay. All right.
Thank you. Miles Anderson is a chief sponsor.
What?
Senator Mona Anderson is a chief sponsor.
Put Laura down.
Put
Mona Anderson down for now. We'll work it out later.
Okay.
And so I will open a public hearing now on House Bill 2015.
And we do have.
Anybody signed up for this?
That'd be good.
Eva Rippentau, Ashley Jackson, and Michaela Martin. Could you all come up, please?
You don't want your... Michaela, Mom, sit down first. Come on, baby. You ready?
Didn't get daycare today.
We found out last night at 5 o'clock in the evening. So, thank you so much for having
us. Illustrates what we're trying to talk about.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
That's
told me it was an excuse. No, that's fine.
Children are always welcome.
Well, thank you. We appreciate
it. They really are. So introduce yourself to the committee, please, and give us your testimony.
My name is Ashley Jackson, and I'm a student at Lane Community College. And I just want to say thank you to our chairs, Nathanson and Bates, and to the members of the committee for having us here today and for working on this bill. It's very important. I am, like I said, a student at Lane Community College. I am also the student body president, and I... I'm a voting member on the board of directors of the Oregon Student Association, and I am also a Ford Family Foundation Scholar, class of 2015. And I'm here in support, obviously, of House Bill 2015, as it will provide much-needed stability for student parents, as it will open up their eligibility to the employment-related daycare. My experience with Department of Human Services started really young. I was 16 when I had my son, so that's really my first experience. In 2011, I became eligible for ERDC as I was a single parent at that time of two kids. And I spent a year working full-time and realized that I was stuck in a trap, that I was never going to make enough money to be independent financially if I didn't get an education. So despite the constant discouragement that I was getting from my caseworker, I enrolled at Lane Community College. That really was like my way out of the system. I didn't want to be, you know, on benefits my whole life, and I wanted to be able to contribute to my community the way that my community had helped me. So the first year, like I said, was really difficult. I was not supported by my caseworker. I was told time and time again that it was too much, that I had too many schedules going on, and I would be better off just working a job, not going to school. I eventually canceled my ERDC because I couldn't take the constant discouragement anymore. I was really committed to my school, so I enrolled in more credits, canceled the employment-related daycare, and committed further to my studies. And after a year, I ended up receiving a grant for childcare through the Lane Child and Family Center, which was something that administration worked on really hard to provide for students, and it paid for almost 70% of the cost of one of my children to go to a nationally accredited childcare center. This grant really ensured that I gained traction in my studies and that I could commit to participation politically. It's why I'm here today. And I know that if employment-related daycare was opened up to students and the eligibility was made easier for students, that it would help stabilize us and improve our financial futures. I want to be clear that the requirements currently for ERDC in the framework of DHS is stopping us from gaining that financial independence that we all strive for. I think everyone knows that education and parenting goes hand in hand, but I think, and I just want to say thank you, first of all, because yesterday when I heard about this bill coming through, I was really encouraged. I actually started going to school because of the experience within DHS, and I just knew that there had to be a better way to help people, and that I'm going to be going into public policy and law. So hopefully I'll be sitting one day where you are doing the same thing, helping students like me gain traction and be able to come here and contribute to the political, participation that is so critical to our democracy. I can't stress enough that if I wasn't a student, I wouldn't be student body president. I wouldn't have that amazing experience to put on an application and a resume. I wouldn't be receiving a full ride scholarship through a bachelor's program and possibly extending that to a master's program. And very few students have been as lucky as I have to be able to receive that kind of funding, to be able to receive that kind of stability, to have a child care center like Lane does. It's very unique, and the support that I have there is extremely unique. And I just want to urge you to see the safe passage of this bill forward and to once again reiterate, thank you so much for the work that you've been doing on this. It's very encouraging as a student who has been struggling for a long time to make ends meet and to gain some standing to see something like this come forward. So thank you very much for all the work that you've done. And I please encourage you to read my 10-minute-long testimony. That was the abridged version. So,
thank you for your testimony, especially your story. It's one that's uplifting. It's also one that's disturbing when I hear what your relationship with your caseworker was. They're supposed to be encouraging people to get education and move on. You heard my earlier comments about the TANF program. I congratulate you on doing what you've done.
Thank you.
We need more people in our society doing exactly what you've done, and you're a shining example to others, and I really appreciate your testimony this morning. And I would like to have an offline conversation about your relationship with DHS.
Absolutely. I do encourage everyone to read the testimony because it is more explained in depth there. I did start writing it at 7 o'clock last night, so thank you very much for having us here. And I will be available. So.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
The bill in front of us also is going to allow exactly what you've talked about to a degree. We believe there are some federal requirements that have to be met, but that we do have some leeway to help young parents who have children to stay in school with ERDC support. So some of that is in this, and you probably are aware of that already.
Yeah, I read it last night, and like I said, it was extremely encouraging. It's a step in the right direction. I'd like to see a lot more things like this come forward and more development and expansion on it, but it's really the right step in the right direction. So
couldn't agree more.
Okay.
Senator, start ahead with
you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to go into this too far, but I, too, was a little concerned about your comments about being discouraged about continuing your education. When you follow up with Senator Bates, maybe I can learn from him a little bit more. Maybe we can hear. I don't know. I see Ms. Kelly still in the audience, and maybe she can give us a little bit more information. I hope that this is an anomaly. I expect it's an anomaly because I know we usually do it, but I see you shaking your head. So I'm not going to go into this in detail because it's anecdote, but I do want to hear a little bit more as well.
I will be available, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your
testimony. I'm going to step away and help.
Thank you.
Good morning. Sorry about the fussy child. It's terrible to sit
kids, in. Kids are always welcome. Children are always welcome.
My name is Michaela, and I'd like to thank you for having me today. I'm currently dual enrolled at Lynn Benton Community College, as well as Oregon State University. I'm also the Student Body Center Coordinator for LBCC's Lebanon campus. Going to school as a parent is incredibly difficult. You can only imagine what doing homework is like. Not always the most fun. But even with working full-time when I was and making more than minimum wage, my wages hardly paid for, you know, my ERDC copay, as well as, like, you know, rent and my insurance, electronics. I still had to take out maximum student loans in order to be able to afford childcare for the time that I was in classes, which meant that while I struggle with supporting my child and myself, I'm also taking on a heavy debt load. I was actually ended up having to quit my job because between the amount that I was having to take out for student loans, I wasn't coming up on top at all. I was kind of just working for nothing. It's kind of hard for me to talk about. I hate living off the system. And for me, the only way to get off the system is to go to school. And I know that's for many, many people. And things like the jobs program at TANF, they don't encourage you to go to school. And again, working full-time doesn't get you off the system. Working full-time at a minimum wage job, you're still on insurance. You're still getting food stamps. You're still getting housing assistance. Like, as a single parent, just getting a job isn't the answer anymore. Like, you have to do more than that. You have to get, like, a better paying job. The only way to do this is to go to school. And, like, there's, like, such small support for that kind of thing. And, like, childcare is ridiculously expensive when you're paying all out of pocket with no help. So, for me, again, I don't want to be dependent. I want to be self-sufficient. And I've spent a lot of time at the pregnancy center, like volunteering and going to classes and things, because being a single mom is, like, it's a lot to take on, you know? And a lot of those girls, I ask them all the time, like, why don't you go to school? Like, what's holding you back? And they're like, what am I going to do with my kid? I can't go $20,000 in debt with, you know, three children. Like, that's not, and 20s, it's just, that's lowballing. By the time I get my bachelor's, I'll be $58,000 in debt. Like, that's pretty heavy. And I just think by passing this bill, it will help not only get people like me to be able to go to school and get a job that will actually get them off of the system, but it will also help our 40-20 goal, is that it'll put more people in school and help educate our children, because first-generation children going to college have some of the lowest success rates. So if we get their parents to go to school, they'll go to school. And it's just kind of like helping end the poverty cycle. So I'm so emotional. Mm-hmm. It's really hard for me. It's
an emotional topic. Thank you for your testimony.
Yeah. I'm going to pull the child at this point, in case anybody has any questions.
Thank you, okay.
Co-Chair Bates and members of the committee, that's going to be tough to follow. My name is Eva Ribotome with Oregon AFSCME Council 75. We represent licensed in-home child care providers. And the providers that I work with have been excited about the policy changes for themselves and for parents like Michaela. And the additional families that would be served with the passage and funding of HB 2015. I haven't yet submitted my written testimony, but I'd like to encourage you to look it over and also look at the note that I have attached to it, or will attach to it. It's from one of our members who works at WorkSource in Lane County. And then also encourage you to look over the remarks from the February 9th policy hearing on the bill. In late 2010, employment-related daycare, like most programs in the state, was cut, and the number of families that could access the program was capped well below the 11,000 to 12,000 families that previously accessed the program each month. The economy improved, but people were landing jobs that paid less than what they used to make. However, employment-related daycare remained capped. At the same time, we began to have discussions about early learning and the link to school readiness. We created our state's quality rating and improvement system, and with the goal of having all families be able to afford be able to access affordable, quality childcare that worked for their hours and needs. However, we didn't expand the funding that would support providers in making the professional development achievements needed to participate in QRIS or for expanding access to families in need of childcare. Needless to say, I was thrilled when Speaker Kotek asked me to participate in group discussions to rebuild and strengthen employment-related daycare. HB 2015 is the result of that group's work. Each piece of HB 2015 is important. The changes in the bill not only provide stability and improvement for providers, they also provide stability and improved access to care for the families in the program. I'm excited about the advances made in the bill. However, that excitement is diminished by the disappointment that I feel about the level at which HB 2015 is being funded. Currently, there are about 7,800 families that's being served through employment-related daycare, with 3,821 families on the wait list. That is 3,821 parents who are in need of child care so that they can go to work and provide for their children. And that list grows every day. Those were numbers given to me yesterday. The proposed funding level will give access to fewer than 1,000 families. It is a start. Or an additional 1,000 families. It is a start, and for each additional investment of $5 million, about 250 more families would receive access to employment-related daycare, and I'm hopeful that more investments will be made to help these families. HB 2015 is an important investment in our children, families, and child care providers, and I thank your support, and thank you for your work, and I welcome any questions.
Thank you for testimony. No questions? Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 2015 and open a work session on 2015.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2015 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
And it has been moved that we move House Bill 2015 to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Oops.
thank you, Chair. This is the first bill that I personally dove as deep as possible. I mean, that I actually invested a lot of time trying to understand. Overall, I'm very supportive of this concept. Unfortunately, as was just testified, this is one of those things where the need and the resources are never actually going to line up. And so we as the legislature will always have to try to figure out what is that balance for a very good program that helps people and more people yet needing that program. Something I am excited about, though, with this program is the exit eligibility and being able to, again, help people transition into the workplace without cutting them off radically fast. And one thing I do want to highlight that I will be watching for, I appreciated those who helped work with me on this. One of my concerns was the part in this bill about incentivizing through decreased copayments the type of provider that someone chooses, and I fear that that's actually going to reduce the number of people choosing their grandma or their relatives or someone who's a family member or close friend as one of those providers. In order to try to satisfy that, there's Section 5 actually addresses that there will be a report back in the short session talking about did it negatively impact, and so if we find out it does, you know, I'll kind of be raising flags. So I really appreciate that we're going to take a look at that to make sure there isn't an unintended consequence there.
There you have it.
Thank you. And I'll pause for a moment because we're running out of time in this committee this morning. We've got a lot of work to do. I'm still bothered by this with the issue of quality versus quantity. I believe we should demand quality and increase the quantity, and simply pay more for what we think is quality without good supervision of that quality concerns me. I think the bill is weak in that area. We could have had more families involved here, and I think we're using more family members who I think would have had quality involved because they are family members at a lower cost, would have brought more families in. People always want more money. This is a tremendous improvement over what we've got, and I don't really appreciate people saying, and I think we've underfunded it. This is a great budget we're putting out here in this building, and there will never be enough money to take care of everything. So I think it's a great step forward. I appreciate the hard work that's going on. And if you think this is a bad budget we're putting out in DHS, you need to think again. So I'll take them. We're still in. Where are we here?
Oh, I think so. I was going to say something, and I've just changed my mind. I don't want to say anything. Thanks.
So we are in.
We have a motion before you.
motion before us for moving House Bill 2015, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means to pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so moved.
Some carriers.
Ground carriers.
Default?
I'm guessing this.
We're going back and forth here.
I'd like to, if I could, that'd be okay. Thank you.
And in the House, Speaker Kotek, please.
I'm actually the co-chief. This is the ERDC bill. I'm the co-chief sponsor on it.
So do it all the way through.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. And I close. If I haven't, I do now close the work session on our last bill. We're moving to House Bill 5026 now, Department of Human Services. We'll take three parts of that budget.
Okay. Just open the work session.
And I will open, I thought I just did.
Well, you said open, take it
out. I will open the work session on House Bill 5026. We'll talk about three parts of that budget today. We'll do three more on Monday.
So, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, in OLIS today there are three different packets for three different parts of the Department of Human Services budget. Similar to what Ms. Ames walked through you for the Health Authority budget, we've got the same sort of format for Human Services budgets. The first packet I'd like you to look at is the one for vocational rehabilitation. There's a memo, and then attached to it is a worksheet that has detailed recommendations, and then there is, at the very end of the packet, the key performance measure that relates to vocational rehabilitation. I have attached for this agency where there are specific key performance measures associated with that program. We've included them in that program packet, so you can see them as we talk about the budget. So the short story on vocational rehabilitation is that this budget is essentially flat. The federal funds are flat. There is a package in the budget. If you want to turn to the spreadsheet attachment on line 7, package 119 is recommended for approval. That allows the department to repurpose some funding in the budget it's already using to cover double fill positions, to actually create those positions within the budget so they can eliminate the double fills. Those people are already doing the work in the program. In the intellectual development disability program, there is also some work related to Employment First that does actually tie into voc rehab and the work in this program. But that budget is over there because that's where the client population is that's served in that program. So essentially the budget's flat. Other than that position change, there are really no adjustments in the budget. So
Did we start with?
We are in work session. Why don't we start with a motion?
All right. I move the LFO preliminary budget recommendations for voc rehab and House Bill 5026.
It has been moved that we accept the LFO preliminary budget recommendation for vocational rehabilitation, House Bill 5026. Any objections? Seeing none, so moved.
And then there is one performance measure at the end of the packet for vocational rehabilitation. It has to do with the percentage of voc rehab services consumers who have a goal of employment, who are employed, and how many of those cases actually get results. The targets for the next biennium have been included in the packet for your review, and the recommendation is to approve that performance measure with the targets as shown.
I move the LFO recommendation on key performance measures for vocational rehabilitation.
It has been moved that we accept the LFO recommendation on key performance measures for vocational rehabilitation. Any objections? So moved. I need to close the work session.
No.
Let's move on.
We can just have one work session for all the items. And just as a reminder, this budget will be included within that final budget action you'll take, hopefully on Monday, to incorporate all changes to the Department of Human Services budget.
We move us to child welfare.
So the next program is child welfare. Again, you have a memo in your packet with an attachment. There's a little bit more activity going on in this program area, so I will walk through the highlights of the budget. The recommended budget is 9.7% general fund and 2.8% total funds higher than the current biennium's budget, and you'll see as we walk through the recommendations where some of those investments are. And I didn't mention this in voc rehab, but throughout the Department of Human Services, there are some standard adjustments that were made actually during the governor's process that we've continued. Standard inflation was eliminated, and there was a little bit higher vacancy rate taken to help reinvest some of those dollars throughout the budget. So you're going to see those actions as we work through the program areas. So those adjustments are built in. There's also some adjustments for caseload and cost per case changes that are built in based on the spring forecast. You did hear a presentation from the agency back in May on the spring forecast and what those changes were for the upcoming biennium. The budget does continue investments in differential response and strengthening, preserving, and reunifying families. It maintains child welfare at 85.9% of the workload model. Again, the workload model is the tool the department uses to align resources and try and manage staffing and workload appropriately across the different elements of the child welfare program. There's also a change related to 2014 emergency board actions in December. And then there are two new investments. As part of the budget review process with your subcommittee co-chairs, the department identified an area where there's potential savings in the subsidized guardianship program. If we're able to access general fund to provide for more subsidized guardianship payments, there is a potential for some children to not be in foster care, but to be instead be in that guardianship arrangement, which is a lower cost per case scenario for budgeting purposes. So there is $1.8 million in general fund savings captured in the budget that's reinvested. We will also see in the end of session program change bill some language clarifying the department's ability to use that money or general fund within that program. So the two investments that are funded with that change is $250,000 general fund to cover the startup and ongoing base costs for a youth shelter project in Lane County. And then there's $1.6 million general fund for the homeless and runaway youth program, which is a statewide program that assists youth and provides services such as street outreach, day drop-in, and overnight shelter services. If you want to turn to the spreadsheet real quick, I don't know what kind of hurry you're in, Mr. Chair. It has the detailed adjustments of which I talked about the highlights. Lines 5 and 6 on the spreadsheet are the governor's budget funding strategies we brought forward for reducing inflation and maintaining a little bit higher vacancy factor. Package 091 are adjustments related to the December rebalance. There was a realignment on line 8 between self-sufficiency and child welfare. Artifact from actually those programs being bundled up budgetarily before. There's still occasionally a place where we're trying to realign those budgets. There's a transfer from ODOT for driver's education. There is some education or driver's education money that comes over to pay for driver's ed for foster youth. And there's also a transfer out to the Oregon Health Authority Medical Assistance Program for an assessment program that the CCOs are now responsible for running. Then the next section are adjustments under Package 081 LFO analyst adjustments. The first chunk of those are really related to reshoot. Again, recalculations for the budget for next biennium based on the spring forecast. The caseload forecast included some decreases in foster care, but permanency, some of the permanency components of the caseload are up, but there is a net savings. There's an adjustment to the federal Medicaid assistance percentage. You'll see this in other budgets as well. So we're getting a slightly higher percentage rate from the federal government. I believe there's a typo in your document. The rate is actually 64.21%. So it was an increase on the federal component of that support for programs. There's an adjustment to the behavioral rehabilitation services inflation. As part of that inflation adjustment I mentioned earlier, it was incorrectly applied, and we need to restore that to maintain a level of funding that's consistent with the settlement agreement. Am I being too detailed, Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes.
So, all right, moving right along. There's a workload update to maintain staffing at 85.6% of the workload model. There's been workload increases related to screening and assessment. And then lines 18 and 19 are the two new investments I talked about briefly before. So that summarizes the budget changes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Steiner-Haywood.
Thank you. Ms. Byerly, you mentioned that this budget continues the investment in differential response and strengthening, preserving, and reunifying families. Is that because we've increased based on current service level or because we've funded the expansion of that so that it really covers all of our counties? Where are we at with that at this point? Because I think that's a really important program that this legislature has been investing in.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Hayward, the current biennium included the full phase-in for those programs.
Okay.
Just for the record, the department did have a package in the governor's budget that added some infrastructure to help with differential response. It was not part of this current adjustment before you. So there are still some places where they are working to bring that program along a little bit more robustly, but we didn't make any adjustments to the base funding that was fully funded in current service level. The investments in those programs total about for strengthening, preserving, and reunifying families is about a $30 million total fund investment, with about $12 million of that is general fund, and that's been maintained. I think the department would tell you there's still opportunities to make that program even better if more funding were available, but that's not part of this budget plan. We did include the capacity and staffing levels to keep them at 85.9% of the workload model in the budget.
Other discussion? This agency and this department have done a great job in changing how we deal with foster children and children at risk in our state. At one point, we were one of the worst states in the union as far as length of time in foster care, and changes in foster care programs here have made a big difference, and I want to give a shout-out to Ms. Day and to Aaron Clay Sales for the great work they've done on reuniting families and strengthening families. I think we're just seeing the beginning of this improvement. I think it'll get better as we go along. You may notice when you look at this, this is one of the few programs that's staying well within budgetary increases when we can maintain. I'm very happy with this budget, and I'm really appreciative of the work that's been done in child safety. I think you guys are doing a great job. And you don't always hear that from this committee, but this time I want you to hear it, okay? So,
Mr. Chair, are you ready for a motion?
Absolutely.
I move the LFO preliminary budget recommendations for child welfare in House Bill 5026.
It has been moved the LFO preliminary budget recommendation for child welfare into and House Bill 5026. Any discussion? Seeing none,
I would like to reiterate your thanks to all the staff who work in this section, particularly Ms. Day. There was some creative looking at what and how we do stuff, and we can do a better job and even do it within our budget, and you have found us some solutions, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
In addition to everything you guys have said about child welfare making progress, I just want to express strong support for if there's any possibility of finding more money for differential response down the road. As Ms. Byerly pointed out, guardianship is cheaper than foster care, and it's probably more stable and allows more self-determination for our older foster, certainly for our older foster kids. Differential response allows kids to stay in their own homes to avoid some of the adverse childhood experiences that we know contribute to failure to graduate high school on time and an increased likelihood of interacting with the criminal justice system. So I just want to put it out there on the record that I think this is a really good program, and I hope that over time we can look for more funding. I know it's a program you support strongly, Mr. Chair, so I'm just putting on the record something a lot of us feel.
Thank you. So, no other objections, so moved. Performance measures?
In your packet, there's a page on performance measures related to child welfare program. I'd like to point out key performance measure number 8. When the department brought performance measures before you during its presentation, it identified a couple of measures that wanted to modify in child welfare as well as a new measure. So KPM number 8 is a replacement for timeliness and permanence of reunification of children with a measure that will measure the percentage of foster children exiting to reunification within 12 months of foster care entry. That proposed measure is recommended for approval along with targets displayed. KPM number 9 is also a new or a revised measure. It would measure the percent of legally free children adopted in less than 12 months. So that's about timeliness for adoptions once children are actually available for adoption. And then performance measure number 19 will be children served by child welfare residing in a parental home, which is looking to see how many kids in the program are served while still residing in their parents' home, which ties back into some of the differential response work that the department is doing.
Thank you.
So I would recommend that those performance measures as displayed are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO recommendation on key performance measures for child welfare.
Is it moved that we accept the LFO recommendation on key performance measures for child welfare? Any discussion?
I'm really sorry. I know we're trying to move along, but I had thought that we'd been having discussions with the department about decreasing the percentage of children statewide who were involved with the child welfare system, and maybe I was wrong that was a KPM that we had talked about, but and then maybe some of these other ones kind of address that, you know, at least by getting at the keeping them in their parents' home. But I just want to say that we know that Oregon has a higher rate than a lot of other states about children in foster care and the child welfare system. So just getting it out there.
Let's get it out there, and let's take a look at it next time around. Okay? Thank you for your comments. Any objections?
Seeing none, so moved. So now.
The last packet before you today is the packet for the self-sufficiency program, which we've actually already heard some testimony on with the policy bills that were before you. So you will see that the budget in this program is, on the general fund side, significantly, 18.8% higher than the current biennium, and it's primarily because of the investments you heard discussed earlier today. I'll walk through the key bullet points. Again, standard inflation and a higher vacancy factor are assumed as part of the budget recommendation or plan. There are built-in adjustments for caseload and cost per case changes, which in this program area do result in some savings that are reinvested in parts of the program because those, although, as Senator Bates said, the TANF caseloads are not down where they used to be, that caseload is still a declining. It does maintain self-sufficiency staffing at 75.8% of the workload model. There are changes related to 2014 emergency board actions. There's a continuation of a 2013-15 investment that adds $450,000 general fund for the Oregon Food Bank. And part of the recommendation does include transferring food programs from the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department to Department of Human Services. There is $1 million general fund in the budget to help Info 211 maintain a statewide presence. And then there are some caseload. There are some one-time revenues in the budget that I wanted to point out. There is an assumption around TANF contingency funds and some TANF carry forward. I would just like to put on the record that there is a small risk that some of those contingency funds may not be available throughout the course of the biennium because that federal law is up for reauthorization. It may simply be extended, but there could be changes to that program in the future. So we'll monitor those closely to make sure that we don't have revenues built in the budget that can't materialize. Then the budget does use $30 million general fund derived from those caseload savings to maintain TANF program staffing capacity, address program changes that you already heard about that are under House Bill 3535, and fund some other program-related initiatives. There's an attachment at the end of the packet that I will walk through with you on ERDC and TANF that lays that out. And then there is a $45 million general fund investment in the employment-related daycare program. It includes the policy changes in House Bill 2015, along with funding to bring provider rates up to the 75th percentile of the market study and allow more families to participate in the program.
Thank you for a quick review.
Do you want me to walk through the spreadsheet?
I don't think we need to unless someone wants to ask specific questions about it. I would point out that even going to the 75th percentile in what is apparently the most expensive state in the union to get child care is something we should discuss at a later time. I saw a hand down there somewhere, I thought. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair. Just a comment. I'm still concerned with the million-dollar general fund for 211. I think I've voiced this before. My concern is that the calls that come in for self-sufficiency and DHS and so forth, I think, I haven't seen that 211 necessarily has the same training on some of those. And I'm concerned if we're having a contract out for a job that I think DHS should be doing. And I've voiced those before. I just am saying it again.
I'm just going to say, if I may, that we've had this conversation before. I would disagree with Representative Stark, and I strongly support this and look forward to having more funding for 211 down the road as a para state agency.
The left and right are not meeting on this one, yes.
But wait, she's on the right.
Also, I would invite Representative Stark to go on a 211 visit. I think that really is illuminating because it goes way beyond DHS. It goes into housing issues and health issues, and so it's able to link to many different agencies, and that's the value.
And potentially as that presence grows in my neck of the woods, I may
exactly
see it the same. But at the moment, I am just voicing an interest there and a concern there. So
thank you for your interest. In the interest of time, we'll take a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO preliminary budget recommendations for self-sufficiency in House Bill 5026.
It has been moved that we accept the LFO preliminary budget recommendation for self-sufficiency and House Bill 5026. Any objections? Seeing none, so moved. Performance measures?
Yes. Mr. Co-Chair, there is in your packet a page on performance measures for the self-sufficiency program. There is one replacement for one KPM about TANF family stability. That's KPM number two. And then there's a new KPM related to TANF jobs placements. The recommendation is to adopt the performance measures, including the new and revised KPMs with the targets as shown.
Mr. Chair, I move the LFO recommendation on key performance measures for self-sufficiency.
As we move, we accept the LFO recommendation for key performance measures for self-sufficiency. Any objections? Seeing none, so moved. I will close the work session on House Bill 5026, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 478. And could the Secretary ask, I asked LC to come up here for this, and I don't see her in the room.
Were you expecting?
Yes, I asked her to be here.
Who's working on this one?
Okay. I've taken the liberty as chair today to ask LC to come up because there's a lot of misconceptions and misunderstanding about this in some areas and clarity in others. In many ways, I felt I am far from the expert on this bill. There's been a lot of hard work done by Senator Edwards and other parties. I know this is a bill that is highly contentious. It's hard to say contagious, but probably the wrong word. Slip into my medical jargon once in a while. So there's a couple of ways we can handle this. And it's 15 to 10 or less than that now. I want to know from the committee how many of you can stay here because I have to keep a quorum. This should take us about, if we do it properly, I believe, almost a half an hour.
Mr. Chair, we have caucus at 10 now. I've been informed.
Well, I haven't been.
Well, that's my staff.
That's a pretty big change considering what we're trying to do here right now.
I understand. I'm just
ask,
information.
Could you ask the president to come down and speak to me for a moment, please?
I don't have a phone number list.
Do you want me to text him?
Can we stand at ease for just a
moment?
Yeah,
let's stand at ease.
Are you from LC? Okay, LC is here.
No, LC is
here. Sure that
and we have, you're on? Wow. We have delayed our caucus till 10:15. I'm hoping the House can stay with us on this. We need you here. LC?
I'm right here.
Oh, sorry. I'd like to have you come up and explain to the committee, I believe, the Dash 20s.
Cool. Thank you.
Is that correct?
Rocks.
This is the combination of the 16s and 18s?
Yes. For the record, this is Maureen McGee from Legislative Council. The Dash 20s are, just to make sure I'm confirming for myself, the Dash 20s are the combination of the 16 and the 18s and include an appropriation. So the Dash 19s are a combination of the Dash 19s are the combination of the 16 and 18s. The 20s are a combination of the 16s and 18s plus an appropriation.
Thank you. I'm going to ask you a couple of specific questions about these amendments.
Okay.
Or the amendment. Is this as close to copying the Washington system as we're allowed to do under constitutional law in the state of Oregon?
Senator Bates, members of the committee, the Dash 20 amendments do track the Washington law in the respect that they will adopt they track as closely as we can under the Constitution to require an adoption of the same list, and having the updates to the list be done over time in a manner that considers how Washington is updating and changing their list. They also track the Washington law for purposes of the notice requirements. So when the notice requirements are going to apply, they will apply identically under the Washington law as to how they would apply in the Dash A20 amendments.
And in comparison to the dash 17s, there's no sunset on these. Is that correct?
That is correct. There is no sunset on the there would be no sunset on the bill if the dash 820s were adopted. The dash 17s sunset in 2020. And the dash 17s would not require the first notice to be submitted until 2018.
And would these, would the dash 20 amendments continue the phase out in 6.5 to 6.5 years, I believe?
Senator Bates, members of the committee, yes, the dash 20s would continue to include the phase out that is currently included in the A. N. Gross bill.
And just for the record, Senator Edwards informed me as we walked down the hallway that he had misspoken and wants to be corrected on the record that it's 6.5 years, not 8. And when we have this kind of a complex bill, I have misspoken so many times, I don't want to even talk about it. So I think we can give him a pass on that, okay?
Senator Bates, members of the committee, if you'd like me to just add on that, the way that the phase out works is it's going to, you're required to begin phasing out the chemical 6 years after your first notice is required. First notices under the bill would be required 2 years after the list is adopted. So if you're a manufacturer that would be subject to the bill as of the effective date, then it is true that you wouldn't be required to start phasing out the chemical until 8 years after the effective date. So in a way, both 6 years and 8 years are correct.
Okay. I'll look at that later. What are the two? I understand there's two off ramps for this with the phase out.
So there are off ramps in a couple of different places, both under the notice requirement and the phase out. And again, just to be clear, I'm talking about the A. N. Gross bill as it would be if the A20s were adopted. So the first off ramp would be under the notice requirements itself. The A20s add a provision that exempts manufacturers from the notice requirement if they can. If they can show to the authority that the chemical is included in the children's product only as a contaminant and that the manufacturer had a manufacturing control program for that contaminant that fulfills minimum standards that will be adopted by the authority by rule. So that is an off-ramp at the notice stage. You wouldn't be required to submit a notice at all, and if you're not required to ever submit a notice, then you're not required to eventually phase out. And then at the phase out stage, there are a number of different ways that a manufacturer can qualify for either an exemption or a waiver. And just to make sure that I do not misspeak, I'll try and get the bill in front of me here. So if you are, so this is in section 5 of the A. N. Gross bill. For those that would like to follow through with me, it's on page 5 of the A. N. Gross bill. If you are a manufacturer with 25 or fewer employees, you can apply for a 2-year extension to meet your notice requirement. So that's one off ramp. If your product contains the chemical at a level that is at or below allowable levels for children's products as established by the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act, which is a federal law, then you're not required to phase out use of the chemical. If there are any other federal laws between now and when the phase outs begin to apply, adopted, that establish allowable levels for children's products, and the product contains the chemical at a level that is below that, the authority may not require the manufacturer to comply with the state standard if it's complying with the federal standard. So those are all off ramps. In addition to those, there is a there is a waiver provision, and that's in section 7 of the bill, or section 7 of the A. N. Gross bill. And the waiver provision will apply if the manufacturer submits an application for a waiver that includes either an alternatives assessment demonstrating that removal of the chemical would not be financially or technically feasible, or a quantitative exposure assessment demonstrating that the chemical is not reasonably anticipated to result in exposure based on a leachability and bioavailability analysis. So those are all of the different off-ramps from being required to remove the chemical under the removal or substitution.
Thank you, and thank you for coming up here this morning. I really wanted, as neutral as possible, a discussion of this bill before we take a vote on it today. Either side could have come up here and given us their side of the story. I know this is a very important bill. I have not been lobbied as long and hard and at times in a rather negative fashion on this except one other time in my career here in 15 years. So I realize that for many people they feel the stakes are very high. Discussion and any question to LC?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The exemptions you mentioned for that we have in this bill, or assuming we adopt the Dash 20s, are those do those exemptions exist in Washington? Are they do they mirror the Washington exemptions?
Senator Bates, Representative Stark, members of the committee. I have to admit that I am not certain at this time. I didn't review that before I came in to testify to see if those exemptions were identical to the exemptions under the Washington law. What I can say is identical is at least identical as close as we can get within our constitutional bounds is how the list will be created and maintained and when the initial notice requirement is going to apply to manufacturers.
May I follow up? Thank you. And my, you know, for discussion as well, my hang up on this has been about the phase out portion of this. So I have a couple questions on that. One is, are there other states that have implemented the phase out that we're proposing? Because I'd rather see us collect the data, then have the data, then make a decision. And we can talk about that in the 21s if that's all right. And the other is, you know, as I'm looking at the fiscal about implementing this now, what is there a prediction on in 6.5 to 8 years what our fiscal will be at that point based off of implementing the phase out at that point?
So, Senator Bates, Representative Stark, members of the committee, just addressing the fiscal question first, I'm not the representative from fiscal, so I can't answer that question. And as for your initial question, I do not believe that there are other states that have implemented a phase out similar to the one that we are proposing, that is being proposed in the AN Gross bill.
Representative, did you want to say something? Your finger was twitching.
Yes. Thank you. I won't go into details about other states, but happy to share what others are doing. California has taken a very big step looking at 1,200 different chemicals. Ours is more modest in that way, and they've got four different steps that could lead to phase out. The fiscal came, that was raised, Representative Olson raised that in our last hearing, saying if we have 87,000 in the first biennium and I think it's 409,000 in the next biennium, doesn't that mean that we might, you know, exponentially grow that way? The reason for the 409,000 in the following biennium is because approximately 150 of that is setting up a database. After that, it's just maintaining it. And so I did ask the Oregon Health Authority what their best guess estimate would be for the third, fourth, and fifth biennium. Their response to me was approximately 432,000 because the database will already be created, so you are saving the 150,000. On the other hand, you're going to increase your research analyst and your toxicology person as the waivers come in. Of course, we won't know exactly what that is until we see how many waivers they're evaluating.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair? It's also my understanding, and Representative Kenny Geyer, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, that we have if we incorporated the Dash 20s, that our sportswear exemption would be slightly broader than Washington's is. And Washington also doesn't have the small business exemption, the under $5 million exemption that we have, that we put in to protect
smaller businesses from this because we thought it would be an undue burden at that point. It's really targeting the big manufacturers of these things. So that's one of the two significant differences that we have with Washington, in addition to the phase out, which goes in the other direction.
Right.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Bates. I'm not sure if you're the drafter that worked on the 21s as well. Would she be the appropriate person to talk about the differences?
We don't have a motion on the floor right now. We've opened a work session on the bill.
Right.
You may want to make a motion, and then you may want to ask the question.
Okay. I'd like to move that we adopt the Dash 21 amendments.
Is it moved that we accept the Dash 21 amendments onto the bill?
We can discuss the 21 that we don't have approval to vote the 21.
You want?
We can discuss the Dash 21.
I understand that. Okay. So would you give us a rundown of the Dash 21s, please?
Yes. So the Dash 21 amendments replace the A engrossed bill with a program that is similar but differs in some respects. First of all, just for some background, the A21s are a combination of the A17 amendments and the A19 amendments. For that background, it sets up a program that differs in some of the following key respects. I may not have caught all of them. I may not cover all of them today, but some of the key respects are that the A21 amendments do have a sunset on them. So the program, and they do not have a emergency clause, so the program would go into effect January 1st, 2016 and sunset on January 1st, 2020. Both versions require the initial list that would be adopted by the health authority to be the same, but the way that the list could be modified over time is different. So under the A19 amendments, which do not change how the A engross bill would work, the authority would review the list of chemicals once every 3 years and be allowed to add up to 5 chemicals to the list during that 3-year revision period. The bill would require the authority in the course of those revisions to consider Washington's list and all other state and federal lists in doing their revision analysis. And again, that language directs the authority to maintain a list that's in line with what other state and federal governments are doing. The A21s would also allow the authority to make recommendations on changes to the list, and they would also be looking at what other state and federal lists are looking like. Their recommendations would need to be based on certain evidentiary thresholds showing that the chemical is harmful, but the recommendations would have to have legislative approval in order for the list to be updated. Under the reporting requirement, the Dash A19s, which do not change how is currently provided for in the A-engross bill, would require biennial notices that begin 2 years after the adoption of the list. The A17s require a phase-in of the notice requirements, with the first notices being required 2 years after the adoption, or 2 years after the effective date of the act, so that would be in 2018. The notice requirement is phased in to apply to particular manufacturers based on certain factors and consistent with Washington's phase-in of their notice requirements. There's a new provision that is included in the A19 amendments, and that is also included in the A21 amendments, and that's the exemption that I already discussed in the notice requirement for manufacturers that demonstrate the chemicals present as a contaminant and that they have a manufacturing control program in place. So that's in both. The phase out is not included in the A21 amendments. The phase out under the A19 amendments, the A19 amendments do not touch the phase out that's currently included in the engrossed bill, as we previously discussed. And then I believe I already discussed the timing differences that the A21 bill has a sunset. A21 amendments have a sunset. The engrossed bill, as amended by the 19s, would not. And the other provision that is present in the A21s that is not present in the engrossed, as it would be amended by the A19s, is a preemption of local laws provision. There may be some other differences as well. Those are the key ones that I could think of.
Thank you for your testimony. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to be fair to all sides here and to listen to everybody as much as we can. I appreciate the incredibly hard work that Senator Edwards has done to get the bill to this point, and I appreciate the hard work he's done. This session has been rife with, I think, more opportunities for compromise and people working together that we have passed. There's things in the A21s I like. There's a lot I like in the A20s. And that's just my opinion for what it's worth, but we are at the five-minute mark here at this time, and we're going to leave the building in a few days. I think we're going to have to make a decision here and move forward. So we have before us the A21s. I'm going to ask the question on the A21s. Are there any objections? Oops.
Just a quick question is if, and I'm sorry if I missed it. If you said it, I was trying to follow through all these. If the federal government adopts some rules, do they overlay what we do?
So are you asking under either the A21s?
Yeah, in any case, because either any of those amendments and the bill, et cetera. If they adopt, and I've heard they're working on stuff, mm-hmm. and if they do adopt something, does that take over whatever and prevail over what we do?
Senator Bates, Representative Boone, members of the committee, yes. There are provisions in the removal and substitution requirements under the engrossed bill that specify that if the federal government adopts allowable levels for chemicals, then the manufacturers are subject to the federal law. And the A21s do not have a phase-out requirement, but they do require in the adoption and revision of the list that federal requirements would be considered.
Thank you.
And that's also required under the English
question. Bill. So, again, I'm going to call the question on the A21s. Are those who object, please raise your hands. The motion fails. Representative Stark, thank you for bringing it forward. I honestly appreciate it. I'll take a motion.
Mr. Chair. I move the dash A20 amendment into Senate Bill 478.
Is a move that we move the dash A20 amendment into Senate Bill 478. Objections? Record that Representative Stark and Representative Olson object, and that Senator Winters was an excused absent. Second motion.
I move Senate Bill 478 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation as amended.
It's a move that we move Senate Bill 478 to the full committee with the due pass recommendation as amended.
Discussion.
Thank you. Just a comment. My own personal journey on this bill, I'm actually very, very much for the reporting on this. I think we need to take a good, hard look at what's going on with it. My hang-up with and the reason for the objection is in that I don't want us to make an assumption and go straight to the phase-up. That's my one and only hang-up. That being said, I actually am trying to get my hands on the data for Washington to see if the assumption should be made, and I'll go through my own personal journey on that. So I reserve my you know, freedom to make decisions later and so forth. At this point, I'm a no because I haven't seen the information that warrants the assumption at this point in time that we need to go straight to a phase out. The rest of the bill, I actually am quite in favor of. So,
Thank you for your comments. I'll echo some of those comments, too. I think the phase-out still has some importance because it brings reality to this. We're going to have several more sessions before those take effect. There could be changes made. I also let you know that this bill will be moving to the full. It has a difficult passage yet through the Senate. It's going to be a contentious bill there. And I'm not guaranteeing anything on the floor of the Senate nor in the House, but I have no control or thoughts about the House. You can do what you're going to do. But I am still troubled that a final bill that would bring support from both the Republicans and Democrats was not reached. I think there was a path here, but maybe there wasn't. I wasn't part of those negotiations. But again, I want to thank Senator Edwards for the hard work on this. I think he did a splendid job in getting a lot of hard work done to get this where it's at right now. Last session, a similar bill was not leaving this committee. This one's leaving primarily because of the work of Senator Edwards, and I thank him for that. So I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 478. We will need carriers.
I think I'm taking this in full, Mr. Chair. I've been asked to take this in full, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And on the Senate floor, I expect Senator Edwards might want to carry this.
I expect so.
And then the House Representative can carry.
And we are adjourned.
I agree with you. I agree with you.